There was a time when many of us assumed that big banks were there forever and that nothing could do to really shake their foundations. But then in 2008, we were introduced to the idea of banks too big to fail and the fact that they were, in fact, in danger of doing exactly that. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk this hour with Jake Bernstein. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for his series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that he wrote for ProPublica. He went behind the scenes and found out that there is a lot more collusion and cooperation between those that are charged with keeping an eye on the banks and the banks themselves. We are going to talk with Jake, and we will welcome your calls at the Madison number, since we're broadcasting from Madison today. That number is 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Jake Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you, Judith. I appreciate it.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and you know, I think really it's kind of this whole shadow world that most Americans really aren't aware of, and even if they're aware of it, really don't necessarily understand. So for those of us not steeped in economic policy and regulation, first of all, can you describe the role of the Federal Reserve? What is its charge?
Absolutely. Well, the Federal Reserve has an absolutely essential charge, which is the safety and soundness of the financial system. And particularly after the financial crisis, they were given even more authority, which was oversight of the biggest, most complex banks in the world, frankly, which, as you sort of mentioned, are now kind of known as the too-big-to-fail banks, because if one of them failed, it could take down the entire financial system. So that's their job, is to supervise those banks and to make sure that they don't fail or don't accumulate so much risk that they could be, there could be a possibility that they could fail. And what's interesting is that, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, is that the supervisors of these huge banks are actually embedded inside the banks themselves. So they have their own floor or half a floor, desks and phones and everything, and they're based primarily inside these banks where they work every day.
And I'm assuming also, given how, for instance, members of Congress often leave office and end up then lobbying their own former colleagues, that there are probably people who have worked on both sides of that quote-unquote divide also.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is a revolving door, and a lot of people go from the Fed and particularly the New York Fed to Wall Street. There's not as much of the other side, although it happens sometimes. For example, the president of the New York Fed, and there are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, but the New York Fed is sort of first among equals, although it's not really equal because of its location right off of Wall Street. It supervises these really big, important banks. But the president of the New York Fed is a former managing director of Goldman Sachs. So, yes, it's a very clubby world where there is a fair amount of back and forth.
Well, and even without that revolving door, as you said, if you're working, even if you're in a different suite of offices, the people that you're riding the elevator with, the people that you're maybe heating your lunch up in the microwave next to, those are the people that you are supposed to be regulating. It's kind of human nature that you want to get along with the people that you're seeing every day.
Yes, and this is a very good point. And there's two aspects to this, right? One is that these banks now are so large, they're so complex, that the regulators really depend on the banks themselves to give them the information, to tell them when there are problems or to tell them sort of what's going on, because there's no way that the regulators would be able to find that themselves. So the sense is that if we are friendly with the banks, if we work with them, if we maintain a friendly relationship, we're more likely to get that information, to find these things out. But the other part of it is, as you say, it's human nature. You see these people every day. You're interacting with them all the time. And even if you're not hoping that at some point you'll leap over and get a job with them, it's just easier you know, to be nice to people, and you talk about your kids, and you talk about the Super Bowl, and eventually it becomes a very friendly relationship, and that's not necessarily a problem. But what I found is that it can at times slide into deference, where you forget that your role as a regulator is to enforce the rules with these banks, and then you become captured, essentially, to the institution you're supposed to be supervising.
So that domino effect of failures of banks that were considered too big to fail, and I think that too big to fail kind of has two different meanings. There was the idea that they were too solid to ever have that level of problem, and also then as the level of crisis was evolving, there was the idea that they couldn't be allowed to fail. So the first thought was that they couldn't fail because they were so big, and then the second thought was that they couldn't be allowed to fail. So when they were teetering on the edge of that, and as you said, threatening to take down the global financial market, it was really a jolt to a lot of people. And I think the fact that the Fed didn't see it coming really brought fundamental flaws in that system to light. First of all, how did that series of events take place without it setting off warnings throughout that Federal Reserve system?
No, you're right. It's sort of shocking, and we spoke with someone who, because after the financial crisis, the New York Fed brought in an outsider to do a sort of top to bottom review, and figure out why they had failed and what they needed to do better. That report was supposed to stay secret, but it was made public by the commission created by Congress to investigate the financial crisis.
And that report was by Columbia professor David Byme, correct?
Right, exactly. Okay. And so what Byme told us was that, you know, they actually identified the problems. They had meetings, you know, where they discussed the risk that was accumulating. But what happened was nothing ever came of those meetings. There was never any follow-through where they actually said, this is a problem, we need to do X, and then an action item, and something happened. And this is apparently a big problem with the Federal Reserve, is that they just do not, you know, take that extra step where they actually do something that would involve enforcement, that would involve forcing the banks to change their behavior.
I think one of the quotes that you included, maybe it was from Byme himself, was that the culture in the Fed was that having a meeting was doing something instead of having a meeting and determining what then needed to be done.
Right. And this whistleblower that I spoke with and who secretly recorded while she was on the job at the New York Fed said that she saw the same thing 3 years after the Byme report, or almost 3 years after the Byme report, almost 4 years after the financial crisis. It had not changed. There was still this sort of inability to translate what they were seeing into something proactive that could actually prevent the crisis.
So you were talking about the fact that there were these representatives of the Fed that were embedded in these huge banks, and they were supposed to be providing not so much oversight, but really keeping an eye on what was going on, flagging anything that was of concern. But then after the 2008 crisis, and we should say that Professor Byme's report was published in 2009. Well, published. It was finished in 2009, but wasn't actually made public. But then after the 2008 crisis, the Fed decided that they needed another layer or another element of oversight. And so they decided to bring in new examiners. And how different was that supposed to be from what the usual way of providing oversight was?
Sure. Well, the way it used to work was there were still people in the banks. This is prior to the financial crisis. They were actually called relationship managers, which is kind of a startling title. And sort of they were supposed to manage the relationship with the banks. And then when these relationship managers found issues, you know, that they felt required more investigation, more examination, more follow-up, they would have specialists in that particular area come in from outside, you know, from they were Federal Reserve employees, but they weren't stationed in the bank, and they would do an examination. And what the new change was after the Byme report and after they got new authority from the Dodd-Frank financial reform in 2010 was that they would take these specialists, they were called risk specialists, and they would station them alongside the relationship managers inside the banks. They would be there all the time, and they would continuously monitor. They would continuously look to make sure that things were functioning the way that they were supposed to. And that in order to do that, they hired a bunch of new examiners, new specialists who specialized in different things, say like market risk or credit risk or operations risk or all kinds of, you know, sort of different areas that are important to banking.
And so these examiners were supposed to be kind of a new breed of representatives of the Fed, right? They were looking for people that were not afraid to tell the truth and who, you know, would stand up on principle. And, you know, at least on paper, it sounded like they were really looking for people who would help prevent another 2008 style crisis.
I actually don't know if they were looking for that or not, but this is what Baim recommended in his report in 2009. What he said, you know, is that if the Fed, I mean, the first part was what you had said, that he basically found that the biggest obstacle to the Fed doing its job, the New York Fed doing its job, was its own culture. And it was this culture of people being afraid, you know, and overly deferential to the banks and afraid to speak up and afraid of contradicting their bosses. And his antidote to that, you know, is you need to hire people who are specialists, you know, who have deep knowledge in their respective areas, but also who are willing to speak out, you know, and when they see a problem are willing to highlight that problem and to stand up to their bosses and to really be sort of forthright and powerful in their own right. And so when they hire a bunch of new examiners, I don't know if that was specifically what they were looking for when they hired the examiners. They certainly hired them looking for people who were specialists in these specific areas. What they end up getting with this woman, this bank examiner, Carmen Segura, is someone who fits both of those things that Baim was suggesting.
Well, and we are going to talk much more with Jake Bernstein about Carmen Segura and what she brought out about the culture of the Fed and the big banks. And we will welcome your calls and questions also for Jake Bernstein. He is the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who wrote an article that was co-published with This American Life from WBEZ Chicago. That article was Inside the New York Fed, Secret Recordings and a Culture Clash. It's an expose of the world of Wall Street's top regulator and its history of deference to banks. I'm Judith Sears Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Right now, we are talking with Jake Bernstein about his expose looking at the very, very close relationship between big banks and the Federal Reserve. And we'll welcome your calls. Do you think that we've seen any differences in how banks are regulated after the 2008 crisis? Do you have any confidence in the Federal Reserve and Congress for making sure that that kind of crisis does not happen again? Again, we are broadcasting out of Madison today, so the phone number to join in is 1-800-642-1234. Well, Jake, one of the issue areas that the specialist examiners had as a task was to look at conflict of interest policies. And, you know, it really struck me that these banks that are considered too big to fail might also just be too big to even understand.
I think that's a very legitimate point. I mean, too big to understand or too big to manage. I mean, they are so big and so spread out and so many, there's so many different divisions. And in fact, you know, the Fed recognized that as early as 2008 and instituted sort of guidelines saying that you need to have firm-wide management systems, you know, to be able to understand what's going on in all your sprawling different divisions. And one of the areas where you needed to do that was in conflicts of interest, because conflicts of interest could be, you know, potentially a big problem. For example, if you are a bank and you are advising a client and at the same time you have an investment in another entity and that entity wants to buy the client, that could become a big conflict, right? Because you would want, if you had the, you would want your investment to pay off, so you would want the entity to buy the client as cheaply as possible, but you're advising the client on how to get the best price. So there's all kinds of ways where conflicts of interest can be a problem, and you need systems in place to be able to manage those and to create walls between different divisions and things like that. And so, yeah, this examiner's job was to really look at Goldman Sachs and see how they were managing conflicts of interest, and what she found was very problematic.
So this Federal Reserve examiner that you are specifically talking about, her name was Carmen Segarra, and she was placed within Goldman Sachs with that particular charge of examining their conflict of interest policy. And I say that in the singular because one of the requirements, one of the legal requirements, I believe, was to have a single, like you said, across-the-board conflict of interest policy that applied to the entire firm. And it seemed like one of the things that she kept hammering on and getting a lot of pushback on was that there were some conflict of interest policies here and there that applied to this part of the firm, that part of the firm, but there was not that overall policy. And they didn't even want to provide her with what policies did exist.
Well, no. What's so interesting about this is that the Fed had a guidance saying that you had to have this umbrella conflicts of interest policy, and it's interesting because it's for us, we think of a policy and we don't really understand all the different moving parts of this. But a policy has procedures, it has training, it has an audit function so that you can go and check to make sure that it's being followed. It's got all kinds of elements to it, right? And so she's looking at all of these different aspects. And this is a Fed guidance that you're supposed to have this. The Fed actually, in the lawsuit that she ends up filing against them, the Fed argues that this is in fact not a requirement, even though they demand that banks do it and have signed consent orders forcing banks to do it. But they've sort of backed away from the idea, at least in the lawsuit involving her, that it's a requirement. But she asks for all their policies, all Goldman Sachs' policies, and they actually do provide the policies. But what she's looking at it a specific point in time, which is mm-hmm. the beginning of her examination, and what they provide her is incomplete. So it's clear to her, at least, that they do not have a firm-wide policy as required by the New York Fed, or at least the Fed then sort of was saying it was a requirement, and so she tells her bosses they don't have a firm-wide policy based on the time period that I'm looking at, and her bosses, as you say, they push back. They want her to change her view, and she tells them that she can't do that. She based on the evidence, she would be sort of, in her mind, she would be hiding the evidence that she had found if she was to conclude otherwise. And there is sort of a climactic meeting that she captures on tape where her supervisor, one of her supervisors, tries to get her, spends 30 minutes sort of browbeating her to get her to try to change her view about this issue of a firm-wide conflicts of interest policy, and she, in the end, just won't back down. And a week after that meeting, she's fired.
So just to make sure we're all clear, Segarra was an employee of the New York Fed. So you would think, we would hope, that she would be applauded for doing exactly what she was put there to do. But as you're saying, the response was really different. So she was really, instead of having the clout or the weight of the Fed behind her in making these demands and pushing for this policy, she's actually getting called on the carpet by the people that are supposed to be enforcing this.
Well, this seemed to be exactly what David Byam was talking about in his 2009 report. This is the kind of examiner we need. We need someone who is going to stand up to their bosses, who's going to insist, who's an expert and who will be able to find these things and then will be able to point out the problems. And that seems to be what she's doing, and they're just not willing to listen to that. And what she found so troubling is in that very same meeting where they try to get her to change her view, she says, if you disagree with me, that's fine. Let me submit my report. And if you want to change it higher up on the chain, I understand I'm low person on the totem pole. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. But that wasn't acceptable to them. They wanted her to change it. And then she offered, well, let's meet with more people. I'll show my evidence to whoever disagrees, and we can talk it out. And they didn't want to do that either. What was important was that she be the one to change her conclusions. And she said, I professionally, I cannot do that.
And So who was it that Carmen Segarra was answering to at the Fed? Who was her boss?
Well, she had a couple of different ones, but the person in this meeting was the senior supervising officer at Goldman Sachs, which means he was the top Fed official embedded at Goldman Sachs. And he was a gentleman by the name of Mike Silva, who before this had been chief of staff to Tim Geithner, who was the president of the New York Fed before becoming Treasury Secretary. And Silva had lived through the financial crisis in 2008, had seen sort of been right there in the most terrifying moments when it looked like the entire financial system was going to implode. So he really did believe in supervision, and you can hear him on these recordings that she makes. I mean, he wants to do the right thing on numerous occasions, it seems, but for whatever reason, you know, he just says in this climactic meeting, I'm being my higher ups, you know, the Fed lawyers don't believe that what you're saying is credible, and you have to change your view.
And I think part of why this has not really risen on people's radar is, first of all, the complexity of the issues. And as you said, the 2009 report was not released publicly. And when it was basically leaked, because it was supposed to be confidential, it was buried under all this other information. But I think part of it is that it's really hard to understand what impact it has on an average U.S. citizen if there is this type of collusion between the banks and the Fed. What would you say? Why should this be a huge warning sign for us?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a very good point. I think it's two reasons. One is it's sort of hard to understand how this affects Main Street. And the other is the opacity. I mean, this is just a secret world. We never get this kind of insight. The Federal Reserve works very hard to keep its activities secret, particularly the New York Fed. And so we really just don't know what they're doing most of the time. And it only becomes an issue when there's a financial crisis. And that's why it's important. And that's why I think more and more people realize that it's important, because the impact, we're still feeling the impact from 2008. We're still shaking off that financial crisis that happened. And so if the Fed and other regulators don't do their jobs, you know, there's a chance that that can happen again, or a better chance that that can happen again. And so it's just incredibly important, both for Congress and for normal, you know, sort of average citizens to pay attention to this stuff, because the impacts are real, and we're still dealing with them.
And so what happened specifically for Carmen Segarra? So she sued them for unlawful termination, I believe. And what happened with that case?
Yeah, she was fired, and then she sued for wrongful termination under a statute that was created around the time of the savings and loan crisis, specifically to protect bank examiners who blow the whistle on issues involving rules and regulations. And what the Fed said was that what she had blown the whistle on was a guidance. It wasn't a rule and regulation. She differed. She said that guidance was backed up by rules and regulations. But a judge bought the Fed's argument and threw the case out without ever actually really getting into the facts of the case or whether she was right or wrong, just on the technicality of the law. And she is in the process of filing an appeal for that case.
We are talking with Jake Bernstein. He wrote the very enlightening article that was co-published between ProPublica and This American Life, Inside the New York Fed, Secret Recordings and a Culture Clash. It's an expose of the world of Wall Street's top regulator and its history of deference to banks. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's our Madison number today, 1-800-642-1234. And Jake, we do have a caller. Ray in Milwaukee would like to join in. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I wanted to bring up this counterpoint to this argument. I listened to that show in its entirety, and at the very end of the show, they did mention, oh, yes, and this lady who worked for the Fed, she was turned down three times trying to get a job at Goldman Sachs, and it made the whole program just was cast in a different light in my eyes at that moment, because you know, if she had gotten a cushy job as, you know, working at Goldman Sachs, she would have, of course, destroyed those tapes. They would have never come to light. So I just find her, the woman herself, as, you know, like all the criticism she had, the, most of the program I totally agreed with. But then when I saw in the end, it made me think the only reason she came out with this when she did was because she did not get the cushy job at that, you know, Goldman Sachs. Okay. So it just, it put it in a bad light for me when I heard that at the very end.
Ray, thank you for your comment. That she applied for the jobs at Goldman before she took her job with the New York Fed, and what she says is that she actually applied for jobs at multiple different banks. This is actually a fairly small world, and she's applied for jobs at most of the big Wall Street banks multiple times in the course of her career. So it wasn't after she was fired from the New York Fed. It was before, and she said that Goldman was just one of the number of banks that she filed that she applied to, and she'd worked at some of those banks as well.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. Had she gotten any of those jobs, none of this would have came to light. So it's all too much inside ball. It's like people who work for the government go into becoming reporters, and then they go back to the government, and they go back to being reporters. I just find it all it's too sleazy, I guess. The whole ball of it just totally upsets me, and I don't know where to go from here, but, yeah, there's a problem. There's definitely a problem when the watchdog watching the hen house is actually the fox. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks for that call, Ray. And, Jake, actually, maybe we should go back a little bit, and maybe you can tell us more what Carmen Segarra's background and expertise was. Why was she hired as one of those examiners?
Sure. Well, she's sort of a very credentialed person. She's a lawyer, Ivy League lawyer. She studied. She has a master's from Columbia and the Sorbonne. Studied international law there. Speaks four languages, and she had sort of had specialized in legal and compliance, the area of legal and compliance with big banks, and that's basically helping banks to comply with rules and regulations. And she had worked at Citigroup. She had worked at a bank that then became Bank of America. This was prior to joining the New York Fed. She worked at the French bank SocGen, and then she joined the New York Fed. And she's working now at another bank. So Ray is right. I mean, she's very much in this world. She's worked on both sides now. Mm-hmm. She's worked as a regulator, albeit briefly, and she's worked on the Wall Street side, always within the role of sort of helping banks to comply with the rules and regulations. And I think, you know, it's important because it is so easy to become cynical. You know, it's important to recognize that there are good people working in these mm-hmm. banks, you know, people who want to do the right thing, just like there are smart and capable and good people who are among the regulators who are trying to do the right thing. It's just that the culture of both Wall Street and the regulators makes that extremely difficult.
Well, and I guess to play a little devil's advocate to what Ray said, given the fact that she's a relatively young woman, I believe, and, you know, this is her world, the financial, legal, compliance kind of world, that really the easier route would have been to destroy those tapes and not follow up on it and then hopefully get a different job in a different part of that same industry. And you know, and there are a lot of people that have gone back and forth, as you've said, between regulation and actually working for the bank. So perhaps the easier route would have been that.
Well, I think it would have been hard. I mean, frankly, she was fired from the New York Fed after 7 months. So that's something that's on your resume and that you'd have to explain to future employers. So, I mean, I think if you wanted to take the cynical view, she's suing them. You know, her case was thrown out. You know, she wanted to get this information out, and that's why she released it. But it certainly, you know, know, I mean, it was releasing these tapes and taking this stand definitely does not help her career in any way whatsoever, I would think.
And also going along with Ray's concerns about maybe what her motivations are, there are also some people that are concerned about the fact that she secretly taped people in these meetings without their knowledge and without their approval. How does that strike you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very bold step. I don't think it's something that most people would do. I mean, she says, and I believe her, that it was never her intention to release these tapes. Basically, what started to happen was she began to sort of see things, both in the course of her examination and what her colleagues were telling her, where they were sort of questioning things that she was seeing. You know, where there was a disagreement about what reality was, and she felt, you know, I need an independent record. I need to be able to have something where I can say, no, this is actually what happened, and here, listen, you know, this is real, because she had an interaction with her supervisor Mike Silva, where she says he said that at the Fed perceptions were more important than reality. And she is a very reality-based person. You know, she's very meticulous. She's a into legal and compliance, right? So it's following the rules. And so she felt, you know, I need an independent sort of, you know, record of what's happening. And that's why she started recording. She says that it was never her intention to go public with any of this until she was sort of fired.
We have another caller on the line, so let's go to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
This kind of struck a nerve and I might have missed part of the discussion when I called, but when the question was asked, well, what does this have to do with the ordinary citizen? And maybe something was answered on that, but basically the 100,000 plus that I lost and most all my neighbors lost in the last 10 years, a good part of that was because of this complicity between the government and the banks. That's what caused the housing crisis. That's what caused the stock market crash. That's what caused a lot of the problems in our world over the last 10 years. So, yes, it affects everybody. But the thing is, most people, they can't comprehend it. It's made so complicated that they can't get the connection between the two. And, the big thing we have to do is we have to say, let's put Glass-Steagall back into effect. And the banks will scream and say, we can't be competitive when Glass-Steagall is in effect. You know, how are we going to be competitive in the world? It's like, that's your problem. Okay, you're going to be competitive in the United States because everybody's going to be under the same rules. And let the chips fall where they may. We've had Glass-Steagall for many, many years, and it wasn't a problem. So I think we've got to do something like that, and I don't think it'll happen because I don't think that Congress will ever pass anything like that because of their collusion with the banks.
Let's let Jake Bernstein respond to that, Ralph. Thanks for that call. Jake?
Yeah, I mean, Ralph, I think, well, you know, incredibly, incredibly smart and perceptive comment because, I think he's absolutely right that ordinary Americans, average Americans have really suffered from the consequences of this, but it is incredibly complicated and it is hard to follow, and a lot of it is secret, and so it's very difficult to make the connections, and you really have to work at it, and it's clear that Ralph has done that. As far as sort of reinstituting Glass-Steagall, I mean, I think he's right. I don't think Congress would ever pass that.
And can you just summarize that in a few words for us?
Absolutely. What Glass-Steagall was, it sort of kept investment banking and retail banking separate. There was a wall. So basically, you couldn't be, I mean, a big sort of change that has happened in the past, well, God, now, decades, is that it used to be that banks were, it was a fairly vanilla kind of business. You know, you collected deposits and you lent out money and that was sort of it. And what happened is there were other kinds of firms, investment banks, which were really partnerships, and they used their money for speculation, essentially. You know, they traded on their money. And Glass-Steagall sort of kept those two worlds separate. And when it came down, suddenly these banks could take depositors' money and do that speculation. Investment banks and retail banks, that world sort of melded a little bit, and you have banks that that have become much more interested in trading on their own account, and that's created a lot of this complexity. I don't know if we could ever put that genie back in the bottle at this point, but my sense is that if regulators really enforced the rules and laws that are on the books now, if they were aggressive and rigorous, that it would take care of a lot of the problem. It's just that that does not happen as often as it should because of this deference and because regulators are timid.
We are talking with Jake Bernstein. He is a business reporter for ProPublica. He was featured in the Best Business Writing in 2012 and 2013. And we are today discussing his article about collusion between the New York Fed and the big banks and what it means for us on Main Street. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, today sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Coming up next, our veteran reporter Robert Kaiser joins us to talk about the digital revolution and what it could mean for traditional news outlets and investigative reporting. Right now, we are talking with Jake Bernstein about his article written for ProPublica and co-produced with This American Life from WBEZ in Chicago about collusion between Wall Street, the big banks, and the New York Fed. And Jake, one thing I wanted to ask was, it seems like Carmen Segarra is a pretty polarizing figure in this story. For some, she would be a hero. For some, not so much. Do you think the fact that she's a woman and I believe a Latina woman has anything to do with how she's been perceived?
I think that probably has something to do with it. I mean, it was sort of an obvious question, listening to the tapes and sort of seeing what had happened to her. And we certainly asked her about that. And she said that, she doesn't know if she had been a man, if she'd have been treated any differently. There are certainly a lot of women who work at the New York Fed and some in quite senior positions. So I don't know, but this is a woman who's a small woman. She's not tall, and you're right. She's very sort of strong-willed. She's very competent. She's highly credentialed, and it's possible that people found that threatening, or they dismissed her, or had trouble reconciling what she was saying with her appearance, or who was doing the saying. All of those things could certainly be factors, but I also just think that the culture of the New York Fed was just not ready for someone like her, and probably wouldn't have been ready for someone like her if that person had been a man also.
Let's go back to the phones, and Dan in Madison is up first. Hi, Dan.
Hey. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to comment, I guess. I wonder if many economies are so grossly mismanaged like this. And where's the repercussions for the wrongdoing? Why would we let institutions like this fail? Sure, it's a great upset, but I can't imagine we'd let that fear of, what's going to happen to the economy next, dictate what, us doing the right thing. Example, General Motors type of thing. The companies aren't being run right, and they, need kind of a slap in the face to let them know, hey, you're going to fail if you don't do the right thing.
So, Dan, when you say do the right thing, what is the right thing to do in this situation?
You got to be transparent. I don't think all the secret, if you're keeping secrets from everybody who is supplying you with your funds, how is that right?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Dan. Jake?
No, I mean, I think Dan's right about the too big to fail issue, and I think most regulators would agree with that's not It's not a good place to be. And supposedly they're working on these resolution plans so that they will eliminate this idea that if a bank fails, it would take down the entire financial system. There's real questions about whether they've been able to do that or not. But you would think that if you're going to have an institution that is that big and that important and that interconnected, that yes, you would have to be quite rigorous and aggressive in supervising it, because the consequences of failure are so extreme. And I think there's an open question about whether we've reached that place or not.
Thanks for that call, Dan. Let's go next to Rick in Harshaw. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for Jake is, William K. Black, who's the former chairman of the Resolution Trust Corporation, the entity that was put in place during the savings and loan crisis to dispose of assets and prosecute wrongdoing with the bankers, has made the statement that he believes that the current banking crisis is essentially the same crisis as the savings and loan, and that is a command and control fraud. And I believe he's an associate professor of law at the University of Kansas, so this is a professional opinion of a lawyer. And my question to Jake is, you know, this seems plausible to me. And would that then indicate that the regulator, in this case the Fed, is complicit in that fraud, that they're essentially sanctioning illegal behavior? And is there, I mean, this is what's so frustrating to an average citizen, as the previous caller mentioned, he lost $100,000. There are trillions of dollars of assets that have been affected by ordinary people in toto. And, you know, it would seem that someone in some manner, although maybe it takes the political will, to prosecute this. And I'd be interested in his comments on that.
Thanks for that call, Rick. Jake?
Yeah, I mean, I know Bill Black and his theory on control fraud, and I think it's a perceptive one. I mean, certainly this was one of those things where, you know, you I think there was an attitude on Wall Street in the lead up to the financial crisis that yes, we know that at least among some people that yes, we know that what we're doing is unethical and possibly fraudulent, but it's not going to be a problem unless the entire system goes down. And then if the entire system goes down, if there's a real crisis because of it, then everyone is going to be responsible, so nobody is going to be responsible. And in some ways, that's kind of what happened. You know, it ended up being a prophecy that sort of played out. And I think I think regulators are starting to talk about this, that the tone was set at the top. And I think there's no doubt that regulators enabled that and turned a blind eye to it, and are now, that the horse has left the stable, trying to at least pay lip service to changing it. So, I mean, I think it's I think that the bill is not far off. Now, you know, when you sort of throw around words like fraud and things like that, at least to prove criminal, you know, a criminal wrongdoing, you have to show intent and things like that. And those hurdles are very high in these situations. So difficult to do, if in fact true. But I think it's an important discussion to have.
So what about that issue? What about the banks? Do they have an obligation to be more compliant with not just the letter of the law, but the spirit as well? Or, Jake, does that actually kind of go against their focus on their investors and the bottom line? I mean, are we expecting more morality from institutions that are kind of by definition amoral?
Boy, you'd like to think that you could expect that, and you'd like to think that you know, doing well by your customers and your clients and your business partners, your counterparties, would also be good business. And I'd like to think that it is. So I don't think that expectation is sort of unwarranted, but clearly that's not where the emphasis has been. The emphasis has been on short-term gains and not really being very concerned about who you hurt in the process. And I'd hope that would change. I think there's certainly a desire to, you know, among certain regulators to try to change that. It's just a question of whether they can make it happen.
So we had that report by Professor David Beim that was finished in 2009, and then we have these revelations that come as the result of Carmen Segarra's being an examiner and being fired and bringing forward this information. And then just today, the Fed's Office of Inspector General released a report saying that Fed supervisors failed to examine J.P. Morgan Chase's investment unit ahead of the bank's 2012 London Whale trading debacle. And that situation eventually cost the bank $6 billion. What does that say to you about what has or has not changed at the Fed?
Yeah, I mean it's sort of an eerily similar story, and it sort of again highlights the problems that are going on over there, and raises the question again of, you know, who's minding the store. And what's interesting about that Inspector General's report is it's a 60-page plus report, but they only released 4 pages, a summary. The rest of it is completely secret. And this, again, goes to this issue of it's impossible for the public to really know what's going on inside these regulatory bodies because they keep everything secret. And so, you know, who's really providing the oversight? The Inspector General makes recommendations, and they say that they'll follow up and make sure that those recommendations are being enacted. Well, will they? I mean, mm-hmm. How do we know? So it raises a lot of interesting questions.
Connie in Madison is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Nice segue to my point, and that is that as I've gotten a little bit older, I've become somewhat more conservative about how I understand human nature, and I'm more and more in line with Edmund Burke, the founder, pretty much one of the founding intelligences of the conservative movement, who really said you need to build a world based on the way human nature is, not on the way that you hope human nature can be. That is to say, take the essential qualities of human nature, including greed, into account. To my mind, really robust regulation is crucial to the continued existence of capitalism. I think that there's no reason to believe that with the incentive structure the way it is, that profits will be any less attractive to the future of human nature than it has been to the past, which is essentially why Glass-Steagall was put in place to begin with. Human nature didn't improve in the 1980s. If we still have the exact same components of human nature and response to incentives. So I think that a really robust regulatory system with incentives to find this kind of wrongdoing is crucial to the very system that we're talking about.
Thanks so much for that call, Connie. And Jake, before you respond to that, I want to make sure we get to John in Milwaukee, too, because I think he has an important aspect to bring out in this discussion. John, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah. Congress, the Constitution of the United States says, this is a little maybe off point, but it has involved the Federal Reserve Bank. And Constitution says Congress has the right to issue and regulate the value of money. So we supposedly, sub rosa, gave it to the Federal Reserve Bank when we created that in 1913. And it's been headed by dual citizens and foreigners a lot of the time, including the present vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank. Why can't we go back to the Constitution, nationalize or deprivatize the Federal Reserve Bank and make it a government-owned bank, owned by the people of the United States, and go from there?
All right, John, let me give Jake a chance to respond to that because we're running a little short on time. So I think it might surprise a lot of people that the Federal Reserve is not a government entity.
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides to the Fed. One is this sort of monetary side, and the other is the supervisory side. But the regional banks consider themselves private. You're right, it's this sort of weird political animal that was created, you know, in 1914. And so it's got some issues for sure. I mean, what's interesting is on the supervisory side, which is what we've been talking about mostly today, is that Congress delegates authority to regulate these banks to the Federal Reserve in Washington, the Board of Federal Reserve. And then the Federal Reserve in Washington delegates that authority to the regional banks. And the question is there really the oversight, you know, both from Congress on the Fed and then from the Fed onto these regional banks like the New York Fed? And that's a real question.
I want to thank our callers for really adding to the conversation today. Some really good points brought up. And I want to thank Jake Bernstein for joining us today. He's a business reporter for ProPublica. He was featured in the Best Business Writing in 2012 and 2013. And he wrote a very extensive article and series of articles, really, about the collusion between the New York Fed and the big banks that it is charged with regulating. Jake, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
No, thank you for having me. And you can read the story at ProPublica.org.
Great. Thanks so much. ProPublica.org. Well, tomorrow at this time, Kathleen is back, and we'll be talking with filmmaker A.J. Schnack about his new documentary, Midterms, about the key Senate races in the upcoming election. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.